Session number 11904. Lieutenant Commander HJ Instance, Reel 3, which is generally Reel 4.
Mr. Jura, Instance, Reel 3.
And little did I know that when I'd finished my course for gunner, that I would commission that ship in the dockyard as the gunner of the ship. We immediately got the crew together, trained them up, and joined the Liverpool, I think it was, Liverpool end of our escort group, and we used to convoy from Liverpool to halfway across the Atlantic, hand over to the other end, and then we'd bring the other half back into Liverpool. We did that for about 6 months, and then we were transferred to the Canadian and American coast because the sinkings were getting very, very bad on that coast. I think a lot of Canadian corvettes were caught in the ice up in the Great Lakes and couldn't get down, and the Americans didn't seem to be bothered about convoying. So we were based at Halifax. Three of us went over there, the Witherington, the Whitshed, and the Viceroy, I think those are the three. And we used to bring the ships up from the American ports, Boston, up to Halifax to join the big convoy there, which would then take them across the Atlantic. And it was there that she lost the other half of her. We were coming down from Halifax to Boston in a Cape Cod fog. There are long fogs caused by the cold current coming down from the north and the warm current Gulf Stream coming up, and they can be very thick and they can be very big, sometimes 200 miles long. And we were battling through this at about 20 knots using our radar to warn us of any ship ahead. So we could get there, we had to bring up from Boston a very large Norwegian merchant ship, about 15,000 tons it was, full of bombs and TNT to join the main convoy at Halifax. And it was still foggy when we got off Boston, and we picked her up on the radar, and the captain said, right, we will close her, and when we get within about 200 or 300 yards, we will hail her and tell her we'll take station on her starboard side and escort her to Halifax. And what we didn't know was this Norwegian ship also had radar, the same type as we had, a thing called a 271. And it was quite a good radar, except that you lost the echo in the last 300 or 400 yards. It got lost in the grass. And she also turned towards us, knowing she'd got her echo on a radar, and we had no idea she was doing this. And so there, in the fog, were two ships, one great big one, one small destroyer, heading towards each other. And the next thing we knew, she hit us bow on and went right through the bow and opened the bow up like a tin of sardines. He went through, I suppose, about 30 foot. And, of course, there was this enormous bow towering over us. And, of course, he pulled back, and we started to sink. And there was a mad rush to close watertight doors, and she sunk about 10, 15 feet and then stopped. And I had to go into the forward wreckage and have the door locked behind me to see if there were anybody trapped there. Well, it was all twisted metal, and a 4 foot hammock had been squashed to about a foot. There were boots sticking out of jagged metal, and you couldn't tell if there was anybody there or not. And I came back out again and told the captain that, as far as I could see, there was nobody there. And it had been fortunate, because it was 4:05 in the afternoon, and that is the time when your red, white and blue watches, red watch would be on watch, white watch would be coming out of the mess decks to relieve them, only leaving the other third watch in the mess decks. Otherwise, we would have lost a lot more people. We lost three, and two died of injuries. And so that was that. The bow had gone. So the only original part of the ship really was between the two funnels. And we staggered back to Boston, stern first. It took us 24 hours to get there. And we nearly got clobbered by an oiler in the middle of the night. And when we got to Boston, they put us in dock. And they built another bow in another dock. You know, the American prefabricated idea. Burnt off all the what was left of the bow. And then when it was ready, they brought the bow over, flooded the lock, joined them together and welded it together. But the captain sent for me and said, we're going to be here for about 6 weeks. When you've finished de-ammunitioning the ship, getting all the ammunition out, he said, I've got a signal here. You've got to go back to Wade Island. So I de-ammunitioned ship. I had a week's leave with an English family in Pawtucket in Rhode Island. And then I was back to the ship, and I went by train to Halifax, joined the Empress of Japan, and about 10 days later I was at Greenwich, and I was sent by train with a draft of sailors from the Penelope down to Portsmouth, and then I had to go straight to Wild Island, and then I was given my orders and I had to join the Aberdeen.
Which month and year would the collision have been in 1941?
Oh dear, what a minute. February, I think.
41. You were just saying that you joined the Slope.
Yes, I went to Whale Island and reported, and they said, right, we've got a gunnery job for you on HMS Aberdeen. She's at Londonderry. We were convoying then to Freetown. And I had to get yellow fever injection, inoculation, TAB, all in one go. And then I had to travel up to Stranraer, cross to Londonderry by ferry, join the ship at about 6 o'clock. The first lieutenant said, oh, we've been waiting for you, guns. Have a gin. So I had a gin with him. And then he said, oh, by the way, he said, we sail at 7 and you've got the middle watch. And I thought, oh, my gosh. Anyway, because I didn't know the ship at all. Anyway, I went up on the middle watch and I was feeling very much under the weather with these inoculations and what have you. And about 1 o'clock, the captain came up on the bridge and said, are we on station? And I said, yes, 3,000 yards astern of the convoy. And the convoy was only doing about 6 knots and we'd be doing about 10 or 12. And you had to zigzag behind the convoy and keep 3,000 yards astern of them. And the only way you could do that was by zigzagging. And he said, are you feeling all right? And I said, no, I'm feeling awful. And he asked me why, so I told him. So he said, righto, Guns, he said, you go down and turn in, I'll do your middle watch for you. And he did the remainder of my middle watch for me. But I was feeling really ill, having had all those injections all in one go. Well, we convoyed from Londonderry to Freetown. That was an unending job. It was 28 days down to Freetown when we would hand over to the next convoy group. We would ammunition and oil, turn straight round and bring another convoy back to England. So we had 56 days at sea without any mail and not receiving any, not being able to send any, and your relatives not having the foggiest idea where you were or what you were doing. I did that for about 12, 15 months.
Did you run into the enemy much?
Yeah, we went into the Azores once to, if you got attacked by a convoy, by a wolf pack, there was an awful lot of running around to do. You could see the submarines on the horizon during the day. And the moment you sent an escort off, and probably you only had 4 escorts, you couldn't really afford to send one, The moment you sent one off, before you got there, they just submerged. So it was a waste of time. So what we used to do was to keep close watch on the convoy, close escort, and let them lay it there. And they would come in by night when it got dark. And they would come in on the surface, doing about 16, 17, 18 knots, and of course soon catch the convoy up, come into what they call the brain of the convoy, and then spread out either side.
Come into the what of the convoy?
What they call the brain of the convoy.
Brown?
The rear of the convoy. It's a naval term. But we countered that. We had a very good anti-submarine school in Londonderry, and we had two operations, Operation Raspberry and Operation Strawberry. And Operation Raspberry, at the moment it got dark and you knew the subs were coming in from the horizon, catching you up, the commodore or captain of the escort would send one ship out about 5 miles away with orders to fire everything you had, star shell, depth charges, guns, everything. In other words, searchlight, make as much noise and light as you possibly could. And of course, the submarines coming up, trying to catch the convoy up, they knew full well that there was one or two submarines ahead of them, and they'd go, ah, it's over there, it started. And they'd all chase for that. We would do this for about 5 to 10 minutes, and then we'd pack up everything and nip back to the convoy as fast as we could. And the commodore of the convoy would alter the course of the convoy. So if you, with a bit of luck, you more often than not got away with it. They were hunting for a convoy which didn't exist. And Operation Strawberry was again to counter this coming up in the dark. We used to take on board at Londonderry 50-gallon drums, empty oil drums, and we would bore a half-inch hole in either end, and then we would strap a depth charge set at 50 foot onto the oil drum, and we'd have about 4 or 5 of these, and the escort in the stern of the convoy would wait until it got dark, and then you would push these over the side about every 5 minutes. And of course, it would float, but the water would start coming in through the half-inch holes, but it would take a long time to sink, maybe half an hour. And of course, the submarine had been belting in, catching the convoy up, and it was sometimes chance, but more often than not it worked, on the surface, and suddenly somewhere quite near him, he'd hear a tremendous explosion. And thinking he'd been spotted and he was under attack, he would dive. And of course, once he dived, he was slowed right up, about 4 knots. And of course, he still wasn't sure what was going on. And there may be another one a mile away, heard the same thing. And they'd come up to the surface again and have a look around, see? And they'd start off again, and then there'd be another, the next one would go off. And so they never knew quite whether they were being attacked or what. And it used to slow them right down.
So the drums used to explode at about 50 feet, you said?
Yeah, the drum would take about half an hour to sink, and the depth charge would be set for 50 foot. And the idea was, of course, that it went off somewhere near them as they were speeding to catch the convoy up in the dark. And, of course, in those days, the German submarines didn't have radar. They just relied entirely on eyesight. And in a pitch black night, they weren't quite sure what was happening.
So this would be in the Bay of Biscay, would it?
Or in the Bay of Biscay, further down, on the coast of Africa sometimes. It depends where you got caught.
In 1942?
That would be 42, 43, yes.
Whose idea was it, that these two?
Oh, I think that was originated from the Londonderry School of Anti-Submarine Warfare. Nearly all the escort groups that were based there, in between your convoys, the officers and the ASDIC ratings concerned with submarine hunting went there and sort of caught up with the latest developments and also had a bit of drill practice just to raise their efficiency. There was another occasion when we had lots of submarine warnings and echoes, and we picked up the ping of the submarine. And then, of course, you rush around attacking a submarine, dropping depth charges. And, of course, the faster you rush around and the longer you rush around, the more oil you're using. And so there comes a time when you either have to turn back because you can't, you haven't got the oil to go on, or find somewhere to oil. And we sometimes used to go into the Azores to oil. And I remember on one occasion we went into the Azores to oil, and there on the other side of the harbour, oiling, were two German submarines. And the captain said, right, we'll get this oiling done quick, and we'll get out before they get out. And we did. We oiled within 20 minutes, half an hour, and we were on our way out before they'd even cast their moorings off.
Did you ever sink any U-boats?
We sank one on the Witherington over in, on the Canadian coast.
Can you describe that in detail?
Well, we picked up this contact and left a convoy to attack it. And we had what was known as a diamond pattern of depth charges, with a sort of a double layer. We could fire, we could drop two over the stern as we ran in, and about 25 yards later we drop two more and fire the throwers, which throw the depth charges outwards, and then we would go on another 25 yards and drop two more, and those charges would be set to, we'll say for example, 50 foot and 100 foot, so that you had a box, you not only had a diamond, you had a box-like area covered by the charges. And if there was a submarine, if you were lucky enough to get the submarine inside that diamond, it was usually very damaging, or it was sometimes fatal. And all we got up from this chap was bits of wood, oil, a life jacket, a couple of caps, and a lot of dead salmon and trout, which we hauled inboard.
Are you sure it wasn't a decoy, because the U-boat sometimes sent that type of thing up as a decoy?
No, I don't think so, because all our Aztec chaps were trying to pick it up from then on, and we hunted around for a good half an hour, and there was no more echoes. And the Aztec operators can hear breaking up noises as the submarine's going. And that was reported, breaking up noises, and massive oil came up, light oil.
When would that have been, do you know?
That was 43 over in the Canadian coast. No, 42. That was 42.
You don't know the month?
No, not really. It's all a bit hazy now.
Did you have any other successes, either on the Aberdeen or the Witherington?
We had two doubtfuls on the Aberdeen. They wouldn't say yes, we had sunk it. We had our two four-inch guns manned, in case he came up to periscope, to conning tower depth, but nothing happened. There was a lot of bubbles and disturbances. But he didn't come up, because we were ready to open fire if he did. And the other one was just off Freetown. This was the one lone submarine. And we ran into it, and of course it submerged. And of course if you're, say, 3 or 4 miles away from a submarine when it submerges, he can do almost anything while you're getting there. And so you have to... If the captain's good, he can sort of get a sixth sense of what that submarine commander might do. And then, of course, you've got your echo ping going out, and if you can pick him up, you're fine. You can then follow him in, you see. But before the days of the hedgehog and the forward-throwing bombs, you had that lapse between losing the echo when the echo became what they called instantaneous. You had a ping, 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 And the closer you got, the closer the pings got, until you got ping, 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 and then it was what they call instantaneous echo. And you couldn't do any more hunting then. You just had to run in, but you knew you were 200 or 300 yards away from him. And in that 200 or 300 yards, you had to try and guess whether you turn to starboard or to port or go astern or go down deeper. And so a lot of it was luck and good judgment, really. Well, this one, we couldn't confirm that we'd sunk it. We got oil and bits and pieces. But as you say, could have been fired out of a torpedo tube as a decoy. And, of course, the other thing they used to do to fox you getting a decent echo on them, they had what was known as a pillenwerfer. And it was a large canister of something like Epsom salts. And they used to fire this at the back of the submarine when it was being hunted. And the big can would explode, and all this stuff would create a tremendous fizz. And an inexperienced addict operator would get an echo on that, and you'd be chasing after that echo while the submarine was moving off somewhere else. But a trained, a good operator could tell the difference between that and a real solid submarine. They tried quite a few things like that.
Did you have respect for the seamanship of the U-boat crews?
You had respect for them in when you were in very, very heavy weather, you know, really rolling all over the place and shipping the water in, and your whole attitude was, well, we shouldn't get attacked in weather like this, but you blooming well did. And, you know, there's a chap there in a little submarine, about 600 tonnes, cramped conditions, wet, cold, he still carried his attack out. Oh, no, they were... If anything was going to win that last war, it was those U-boats. If they'd have really cut that, they very nearly did, they'd have really cut that lifeline from America and Canada, we couldn't have done anything. But fortunately, there were two things, really, that turned the tide of the U-boat war. One was the advent of the long-range bomber, armed with depth charges, going out and ranging over the Atlantic. The submarines didn't like aircraft. They could be spotted so far away. And the other advent, of course, was the Americans making the pocket carriers. See, because we had that 600-mile gap that our aircraft couldn't reach, and neither could the American or Canadian aircraft reach. And it was that in that 600-mile gap, that's where they caught the convoys. But once the pocket carriers were being built in sufficient numbers, with every big escort of 100 ships, or say, you'd have in the middle of it, you'd have a pocket carrier. And the moment there was any sort of sighting or echoes, off they would go, and they'd go off in twos. One would be a Grumman Howcat, I think they called it, with 4 or 6.5 machine guns in the wings. And the other one would be another American-type aircraft, and he would have either depth charges or a homing torpedo. Now, the Germans didn't know anything about this homing torpedo. It was kept a very, very good secret. And what they used to do was the submarines were told by Donets, they were given quite a lot of anti-aircraft armament, and they were told to stay on the surface and fight it out, which they did. And they shot down quite a few bombers and flying boats. So the role of these two aircraft, once the submarine was sighted, was in would go the fighter and strafe it time and time again, to kill off or drive them inside so they couldn't fire their guns. And then in would come the depth charges, strung across, you know, in a string. Or he would hang around until the submarine had submerged. They weren't allowed to drop this homing torpedo while the submarine was surfaced. That's how secret they kept it. Once the submarine had gone underneath, they would drop the torpedo just astern of the wash. And the homing torpedo would go, ah, lovely, isn't it? Boom.
Like a snake.
Yeah. And it would home in onto the submarine. There were quite a few submarines stuck with those homing torpedoes. And, of course, they closed that 600-mile gap. And so it was getting tougher and tougher for the submarines.
What were the merchant ship losses like on the convoys that you escorted? Were they horrific?
The what?
Were they horrific?
What?
The merchant ship losses.
Oh, the early part of the war, 40-41, if you set out with a convoy, say, of 50 ships, you'd be lucky if you got home with 12. Four or five a night, once they found you, the wolf packs would come in, and in those days we were short of escorts. That's why we took those 50 American destroyers and gave them bases for it, because we were short of escorts. Four escorts, one up ahead, one on the side, one astern. 50 ships in, say, four rows or five rows of 10. You had very little chance at all, and you just see them go up night after night. And when you got to Liverpool, you'd go, one, two, three, four, four. Oh, we got eight home.
Who do you think had the worst job, the Royal Navy or the Merchant Navy?
Well, I wouldn't have liked to have been a merchant seaman. They just had to sit there and take it. They couldn't do what we did, rush around and drop tap charges and sort of get your own back. You felt you were doing something. But to sit on those ships like an oiler or an ammunition ship, just sitting there waiting, must have taken an awful lot of courage.
You've talked about the way in which the tide was turned against the U-boats. As far as you remember it, did it suddenly occur to you that the U-boat war was won? Very suddenly, at some stage in the war, or was it just a gradual realization?
No, it was gradual, I think, because first of all, you found that you weren't attacked quite so many times in a convoy across the Atlantic or down to Freetown. You then found that you had aerial escort, a long-range Liberator or a Sunderland flying boat, which gave you eyes right out to beyond the horizon for sighting a submarine. That gave you a lot of confidence. And gradually, you were bringing home convoys of 50 or some of the bigger ones of 100 ships. They were coming home without even a loss, nothing at all. And, you know, gradually you began to feel a little easier about the whole thing.
Did you ever think the Germans would win the war because of the U-boat campaign?
No, as I say, there was that very, very bad time, 40-41, and I think most of us felt that if it really got to that stage where we just couldn't get them across, that the Americans would come in. I mean, the Americans couldn't afford it us to have lost the war. And that's how we felt, and they did. They would escort convoys halfway across the Atlantic, before they ever declared war. I remember going out on the Withington. Withington, Viceroy and Whitshed, to pick up the first Americans coming over in two liners. First American troops. And when we got... We got within about 15 miles of them. We saw two enormous... shell splashes, and the American cruiser were firing his 8-inch at us, not quite understanding who we were. And it was rather strange to find that there were three old V&W destroyers going to escort two liners full of American troops, and we were taking over from one battleship, three cruisers and about six destroyers. And when we got to Northern Ireland, trying to round Northern Ireland to land them in Liverpool, we met a terrific northeaster gale, and we couldn't turn. We would have been swamped and over. We lost our motorboat and whaler. That went over the side, just as though somebody had cut it off. And our senior officer of the escort said, I'm afraid I'm unable to turn. And they had to go on the remainder of the way down through the Irish Sea and into Liverpool entirely on their own. And we had to sweat it out for 2 days.